Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things. On community radio, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
We're here at the KHOI studios today on a warm August day. Today we're going to be talking about eggplants, honey butter, coconia shell beans, and we have a special guest. We have a special guest from Wheatsfield Grocery. Bronwyn Beattie Hansen will join us in a little while. This week has been a warm one. It finally feels like summer in Iowa.
Wasn't it a blast last night? It's like downpour and wonderful. And then you wake up and the sun is completely shining. It's fresh. It's in a whole new world. It's like living in the tropics.
That's why we live in Iowa, so we get a little bit of everything. It's been warm, and now we have lots of wet stuff out there. This past weekend was a big weekend in the central Iowa area.
Talk about hot.
Talk about a hot time in the old town. It was Wheatsfield's 40th birthday celebration. The Wheatsfield Co-op has been a going concern and a great part of the central Iowa community.
It's a mainstay of the community, as it were.
Yes, yes. And Donalana Kitchen was part of the festivities. Thanks to all of you who stopped by the KHOI booth. Donna and I were there making noises and things. We were giving out things.
Lana, we didn't know she had this talent. She sounded like a carnival barker. It was amazing.
Be careful. Give
She's the voice now. The voice.
Give the kid a microphone. You never know. And Donna did some cooking demonstrations. She did a wonderful Iowa salad, and it had all sorts of stuff that you could find in Wheatsfield Grocery, all locally Iowa-produced things.
Yes, fresh choice harvest corn, La Quercia Borsolino, and something queen cheese.
It was a really good goat
cheese. It was
an
aged goat cheese. Really, really quite delicious.
From the Milton Creamery and the Carrot King, Gary Guthrie's carrots.
Oh, yes, we had Gary's carrots in the salad.
And the salad was made in a huge, huge bowl. It was one of those dangerous things. She was using knives. She was chopping, slicing, dicing.
It was already too hot.
And it went like hotcakes. People came up and enjoyed it immensely.
There's nothing like a free sample, right?
Another thing, after the salad was all gone, after about the first hour, Donna kind of went into her one of her favorite things, and this was really fun to hand out. She made honey butter.
Two flavors.
Talk about honey butter. One thing I want to mention, I have had honey butter before, but because it was very warm out in the parking lot.
It was extremely soft honey butter.
Yeah, we said sort of like honey butter pudding.
It was like eating frosting or something.
It was good. People enjoyed it immensely. I really enjoyed watching people's faces as they put the taste in their mouth.
Well, I've done that demonstration. Actually, I created the recipes for the state fair where I used to do the Iowa Organic Association. And, you know, when you're handing out like 2,000 samples every couple of hours, it's like boom, boom, boom. So I made two flavors. One was what I call triple cinnamon, which was Vietnamese cinnamon, the regular kind of cinnamon, and Ceylon cinnamon with some, of course, honey and Organic Valley pastured butter, which I think is just divine, and vanilla, right? Okay, so that's your classic cinnamon flavor. Then the other flavor was a little more quirky. So it was coriander, cardamom, orange extract, and then butter and honey. So you really can divide the world into two people. Either they love the cinnamon because it's very classic and they kind of go, oh, that's different for the cardamom. Or people who are like really excited about new flavors love the cardamom. Okay, the cinnamon's okay, but the cardamom, oh my goodness. So it's a very, it's a world dividing flavor chasm there. But it's fun.
Wonderful. How about if we eventually post the honey butter recipes on the website?
Yes, I know I'm behind on my postings, but I will get them up.
She's enjoying summer way too much. I got to get this person
down. I'm on to the next recipes already. So I will have to catch up. The honey butters are easy, and as I pointed out a lot during the demonstrations, if you want to be really crafty around Christmas time or Valentine's Day, this is the easiest thing in the world to make. You pop it in a little jelly jar, and you give it for gifts. It's also a great recipe for making with children. They really, really love to make honey butters, and then they can kind of pick the flavors the way they want to. It's just, you know, you bring the butter to room temperature, you pour in the honey, and kind of suit the flavorings. I just use like an electric handheld mixer to get them really well beaten in. And it's a great thing for kids. They love to eat it. They love to make it. They feel very empowered because they can cook, you know, the whole bit. So
that was a big hit. The honey butter was a big hit this Saturday. And another big hit of the day at the Wheatsfield 40th birthday celebration was the Wheatsfield beer tent.
Oh, the beer tent.
We had a wonderful time.
We escaped from our booth a few times to try the buffalo sweat. I have other things I want to call it, but I won't say it on air. Bronwyn, tell us about the beer tent.
Oh, that was fun. It was a great event. We had 14, I think, both local and regional craft breweries in attendance.
This was for adults only, of course.
Yes. We saw good traffic. There were over 500 people that stopped by the beer tent.
Just the beer tent.
Just the beer tent.
Right, because they had little bracelets so they could count.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. We kept track. But it was wonderful. I think all the breweries that were there did a great job.
There were some really good things.
Good.
So what? Tell us about some of your favorite kind of Iowa beers and where it fits into the sort of the national, very happening scene of craft brews. What do we got for local stuff?
Oh, that is a good question. I have seen the local beer movement really grow a lot in the past 5 years even. You know, we have in Ames here, we have Old Main. There's a new one opening too. And then Des Moines got several. There's Confluence down in Des Moines, and then Exile Brewing Company.
I love these names.
Yeah. Exile just started distributing recently in packages and six packs.
And that's from
Des Moines area.
Well. Yep. Uh-huh.
And then, let's see, Madhouse is also in Des Moines. We had Kelowna Brewing Company was at our event.
Oh, that's right. They had some quite delicious beers.
Yep. They make some great stuff. They're in Kelowna, obviously.
And they make, isn't that the one that makes the seasonal beer?
Well, a lot of breweries have a seasonal beer.
No, but there's one called, and I'm not going to say it right, Saison? Is it the French word?
Saison, yeah, that's a style of beer, and I think you see several Iowa breweries that are making Saisons. Kelowna is one, is making them, and they do.
I think I tasted that. It was quite nice, very nice.
Those are delightful for the season. And, there were other regional breweries we had, too, in attendance, so not all from Iowa. We had Founders from Michigan, and we had Tallgrass was the maker of the Buffalo Sweat that you mentioned there out of Manhattan, Kansas.
All right, I didn't get to taste the Buffalo Sweat. What kind of beer is it?
It is a wonderful beer. It's an oatmeal stout.
Oh, it's a stout. I love stouts.
Mm-hmm. Yep, very smooth. Yeah, it is a nice beer. So,
in spite of the name.
Yeah. Well, you know, I suppose with all the breweries starting up, you got to be more creative than
ever.
Yeah, you
got to have your name stand out. Well, they've done it with that.
Yeah.
So. And then don't we have isn't there something from the Iowa River or Iowa Falls or?
Well, there's, let's see, the other local breweries that we carry. There's Peachtree out of Knoxville.
Uh-huh.
There's Bent River, which is just across. We don't technically consider it local because it comes from the Illinois side of the Quad Cities.
Oh, my.
But it's a stone's throw, so that's we had some of their stuff there. They make a really nice product. I don't want to forget anyone, but there's just so many great local breweries. But, yeah, thanks to all of them that came out to pour, and it was a wonderful event. We had a great time.
You've been Bronwyn, you've been an operations manager at Wheatsfield Grocery for quite a long time. You've been with the organization for 11 years. When I remember back in the old days, maybe even 40 years ago, when Wheatsfield didn't even have a beer department, there was quite a discussion as to whether one should have beer and wine. But it started
but of course.
And it really is a wonderful thing to have, to be able to get good beer and good wine at Wheatsville Grocery now. Also, as part of the 40th celebration, you had a special wine that is called the Wheatsville Birthday Wine. And how does one get one's own wine for a birthday celebration?
Oh, that was a fun process. So, the wine is called Wheatsfield White, and it's delightful, I think.
Who makes it?
It's made by Snooze Hill Winery.
I think they do a really good job.
Yes, I'm constantly impressed with their product. And this is, I like the story behind this particular wine. It's an Edelweiss, the grape varietal, but it's... I think the year is 2010, and so it's been aged a little longer than their standard Edelweiss that they put out, and so the extra aging really converts some of the extra sugar to acids and other flavors. So it's
not sweet.
Yeah, it's a hint sweet. For a dry wine fan, they're going to like it because it's not maybe as sweet as some can be. Mm-hmm. The extra aging really does that to it. So it was a delightful wine. I was really glad to be able to partner with them.
Is that something that you're going to have a stock of for a little while at least?
Yeah. We will hopefully have it through the end of the year. And then who knows? I mean, it would be fun to... keep it going, maybe just with a regular
vintage. Then there'll be the 41st birthday, then the 40s, etc.
We'll see how it goes, but we will have that through the end of the year, I'm sure. And it is really delightful. If people haven't tried it, I would highly recommend it.
One nice thing about wine and beer is that there are so many different tastes, as opposed to just Pabst Blue Ribbon. Really believe that there's much more than that, and you are sponsoring tastings of things. That's a real fine thing. How often do you have tastings at Wheatsville?
Good question. So, we do tastings monthly at the very least. The first Friday of every month is usually a wine or beer sampling, and that coincides with our art opening in the deli seating area. So every month there's a new artist, and we do a little sampling and have the artist in, and people can look at the art and try new products. And then we also, this year, started doing wine and beer classes once monthly. So those are the second Thursday, typically, of every month, and we vary topics. The last class we did was on local beer, actually. And then during the holiday season, things really pick up, and we do samplings weekly on Fridays during November and December. So really a lot of opportunities to try some fun new products. I often try to get vendors or brewers in to sample their own product, too, so they can tell people about it.
Well, I really like tastings because then you get one flavor after the other, and it makes the differences in flavor much, much more pronounced. It educates your palate, as in sensorially. You know, I mean, it's one thing when you talk about this or the wild yeast or that or this or that, but really when you taste it, it kind of sticks in your brain, so to speak.
Oh, definitely.
Very visceral. I love tastings. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of the trends in, all of these new beers and what we're getting into here and what's interesting?
Yeah, good question. So I think the craft beer market is exploding right now. We're seeing more local breweries than ever before, more regional breweries. And so you're also seeing people branch out into new and different things. Lately, I think some of the growing markets within the craft brewery area we've seen a lot of growth in cider lately. So, a lot of cider, especially
apple cider, pear cider.
And cranberries added. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is coming into the fall season. You'll really see a lot of those because it's a good time of year for cider.
We actually have a fairly well-established apple cider. What's the apple cider that's from Iowa, that brand name?
Well, there's Sutliff.
Sutliff,
makes
right.
a hard cider.
I think their hard cider is quite good. Mm-hmm. Quite, quite good.
Yep, they make a nice product.
And these are not sweet. These are really, if one has not tried the hard ciders, they're, especially with fall meals, they're often really... I prefer them sometimes to wines.
Yeah.
The alcohol content is a little bit lower.
Yeah.
But they're just so delicious. And they are not like regular apple cider. It's dry.
Yep. It's some people, I think, perceive cider as sweet, and some certainly can be, but I think a lot of the nicer ones, and Sutliff, for example, too, is very dry.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like when you buy a big jug of apple cider and you leave it and it goes off. This is really a controlled fermentation. It's a very ancient process.
I think a great food drink, too. You know, the acidity in mm-hmm. a drink like that can really help cut through dishes that have a lot of fat in them.
Yeah.
You know, it
yeah.
pairs well with dishes that can be very rich in
I think fats. It's a great meal accompaniment. And it's an old tradition from both England and France, mm-hmm. at least. And then what about some of the other craft brews?
Yeah. Yeah, so I see breweries branching out in different directions. Certain ones, you can tell they really love hops, and so they're making a lot of hoppy beers. And then there are other breweries.
Hoppy beers. Is that like hoppy hour?
that's a good turn uh-huh. of phrase for it there. That would be like your IPAs, your pale ales. Those are very popular. I think I see more craft breweries now turning also to making traditional German styles of beer, Dunkels and Hefeweizens, things like that. And then another interesting...
Oh, wait. Tell me where that fits on the scale. Is
sure.
Is a Hefeweizen lighter or heavier than an IPA?
Good question. I tend to think of them as lighter.
Uh-huh.
Those German beer styles, especially like Hefeweizen and Blondes, lagers, those tend to be lighter, more malt-based in flavor. They're not going to be so heavily hopped as the IPAs. IPAs really are focusing on... typically on the hops.
What does IPA stand for?
Good question. So IPA stands for India Pale Ale. It got its name, it would have been while the British were colonizing or had control of India, and they wanted to send beer to their colonists. And if you add hops have antimicrobial properties, so the beer would last longer the more hops you put in to a certain extent.
And certain bitterness comes.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Bitterness comes with that, but if you could ship it all the way across the world, they were like, all right, I'm fine with the bitterness, I guess,
keep
as long as I have
happy.
My beer.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yep, so having the beer was so essential that it developed this new style. It was kind of interesting.
So imperialist troops do travel on their stomachs.
Yeah.
I'm glad they had beer.
That's a lot of food.
That's what
has
IPA
traveled.
Stands
yep.
for. Good.
Yep.
Also, I noticed that some beers, many breweries, there seem to have fruit sort of flavors added, or honey, or lemon, or
coffee, or chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, to my understanding, the regulations regarding beer making did recently change, actually, to allow for more of those types of ingredients without special recipes. It used to be that if you wanted to put certain non-beer ingredients in beer, like fruit, for example, you had to submit your recipe in a different manner than if you're just making beer
the
regular stuff.
These are U.S. regulations,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep. And so it recently changed and allowed for an easier addition of alternate
right, because these are traditional, especially the fruits and the lambics and talk about what style those are and ales and all of that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. Those would be, I mean, there are all sorts of beers from across the world. So somewhere you could find that they're putting fruit in traditionally or, you know, things like that. Another type of beer that I wanted to touch on that you had asked sort of what's new in the beer world, and this isn't new by any means. It's probably been done in parts of the world for a very long time, but we're starting to see more, you know, I think as people are thrill seekers sometimes with their beer, and they, as they've done one thing, like say they've had all the IPAs that there are to try, they want to try something new and different. And so now I'm seeing a lot more sour beers come on the market, where you're making your beer and you're using maybe a yeast that's not quite as domesticated as the conventional yeast.
Do you see that as part of the trend for more naturally fermented foods?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely has probably a greater diversity of flora than the standard beer. So someone who's looking to eat more fermented foods,
mm-hmm.
I would think, yeah, it's sort of almost like probiotic beer in a way. I mean, probably can't say that.
What a good excuse. Yes.
Right? I know, right?
Oh, it's good for your intestinal flora.
Yeah, exactly, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also unique beer. And so
it gives you a much wider flavor base than just the standard
yes.
brewer's yeast complexes that you can buy that are manufactured.
Yep. So we're seeing a lot more of that. There's a place in Iowa that's doing beer with their own yeast blends.
And what's that one called?
It's called CIB Brewery. They're out of Carson, Iowa.
Which you said there was Chefs in Black out of Carson, Iowa?
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Yep, CIB for short. But yeah, they do their own. They have sort of proprietary yeasts that give their beers a very tart, sour flavor.
Now, also, each of these companies have three or four styles, right?
Mm-hmm.
CIB makes a what, and a what?
Well, all their beers are unique because of the yeast. They have, well, just for what I carry right now at the store, we have a cherry tart, it's called, even though it doesn't have any cherries. It's just the yeast they're using gives it a sort of a cherry essence, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that one's pretty interesting. They started out using cherries in the beer, and then they took the yeast from that. And just the fact that the yeast came from cherries at one point kind of gives it a cherry quality. So they have that. We also have a hot beer from them. It's made using scorpion peppers.
Spicy beer. Oh boy.
Yeah, I know. You take a drink thinking it'll be thirst quenching, and it sort of has the opposite effect. But it's really that the pepper flavor in that particular beer is really delightful.
So, is that a light beer or a dark beer with the heat in it?
Well, it's going to fall somewhere in the middle, I guess. It's not dark like a stout. If you look at the color of it, it's going to be a lighter brown than that. But plenty flavorful.
Mm-hmm. I trust we have a warning label with that on the.
Yeah, it's got some flames on the label, I think.
See? and along with all the joy of tasting, it also treats your eyes. Label designs are absolutely dandy, I think, beers. Also, I have a question, too. All of these local breweries, craft beers, there's so many variations. Do you find variations even from year to year? I mean, if they're dealing with wild yeast, it would be more like wine. You have a good year, a bad year.
Definitely, which as is they fine. Would say, inconsistent product
right.
line. But that means more variety.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that is true of beers where they are using a less domestic yeast, or like CIB, for example. Their beers might vary from year to year. And that is why most breweries go with domestic yeast, because there's not the
it's much
variability.
More controlled, yeah.
Yeah, but there's pluses and minuses, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think adding lots of joy to Central Iowa and to all of us beer lovers out here. You listen to KHOI Radio. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We'll take a little feast for our ears here. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about craft beers and all sorts of lovely things to enjoy the summer with Bronwyn Beatty Hansen of Wheatsfield Grocery. They just had their 40th store birthday, 40 years of being a co-op here in town. And a little aside here, as part of that, a cookbook was made, and it's the nicest looking little cookbook I've seen in a long time. It's a beautiful photograph. So three cheers to Kim and all those people that put it together. It's lots of recipes. I think 40 recipes for 40 years. Look for that cookbook. Well, we're back talking about beer, wine, craft brews, good tastes. Let's talk about Shandy's.
Sure. Yeah, Shandy's are...
This is another trendy thing.
It is, yeah, another beer trend. I've seen a lot more Shandy's this year than we saw last year, and I suppose next year we'll see more yet. A Shandy is basically a beer and fruit juice combination. So in some beers you might add fruit before or during, like during the brewing process, and you end up with a raspberry beer, whatever the case is. A Shandy, usually you're taking beer, and then when it's done, you're
then
mixing it. Yeah, mm-hmm. With, I think originally it probably was lemonade, or you see, of course, there's the Line and Kugels was sort of the first major brand to
Which
be
kind?
Doing it. Line and Kugels. They have a summer Shandy, it's called. And that's sort of the first of the major breweries to be putting them out commercially.
I have to say that this is a trend that's come back. In my old hippie days, which was at least 40 years ago, we used to drink something called Shandy Gaff, which was you made it yourself. You poured a light beer and a ginger ale together.
Oh, okay, sure.
And yeah. That was in New York. I think it maybe came from an English tradition, probably because ginger beer. Or maybe even an Irish tradition.
Could be. I've seen German references to Radler, which is another type of, it's beer and lemonade, basically.
Oh, uh-huh.
Half and half.
Radler?
Radler. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right.
Oh,
but
okay.
That's how, I think that, uh-huh. That's what the word is. And so now we see more and more of those. This year there's a brand out called Travelers, which is owned by Sam Adams.
Yeah, there's a grapefruit flavor one, which I find really delightful.
Yes. They have a grapefruit. They have a strawberry. I'm sure they'll come out with a pumpkin for the fall.
Oh, my. I'll stick with the grapefruit.
Yeah. Grapefruit's a nice pairing with beer because hops can almost have a grapefruit essence anyway. So
Shandies are, what, half the alcohol of beer? I mean, they're...
They're lighter.
What are they, like 4% or something like that?
Exactly.
Sounds good.
So you can drink twice as many without getting
served
loaded.
Served on ice or not? Served on
Well, not typically.
You could chill, usually.
Oh, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. Donna discovered another sort of drink thing.
Here we go. The cold beverage that I'm into this week is called a shrub. Now, I love the word shrub. You know, we all think of it as in the horticultural sense. In fact, I was thinking, Bronwyn, wasn't there a cultural reference from Monty Python about shrubbery?
There was the search for the Holy Grail. The knights who say knee send them off to go find them a shrubbery.
A shrubbery. Oh,
I don't think that's a real word. That was a joke. But
right, I know. But it's a very English-sounding word. Anyway, a shrub is, acidulated beverage, which means it's a drink made with an acidic ingredient, usually vinegar. It's also, it's historically kind of predates, it's what people used to drink before we had soda. You know, the basic concept really is you take a fruit, like I'm going to talk about an elderberry one, a raspberry one is common, any perishable fruit, you kind of pound it with a lot of sugar till it makes a syrup, and you can let that sit in the fridge maybe 4 or 5 hours or even overnight. Then you strain it off and you mix in a vinegar. I'm gonna make some, and we're gonna report back on elderberry shrub because they're in the backyard right now. But I'm gonna use the Bragg's live vinegar. So you're getting those wild yeasts once again. And so then you mix it about equal parts of the sugar syrup with vinegar, and then you let it sit in the refrigerator. I mean, obviously you can drink it right away, but apparently as the flavors mellow, the fruit comes forward and the sugar and the vinegar more drop in the background. And this is actually a preservation technique. I read some rhubarb recipes. I mean, it looks like any fruit. I might even try a peach one because the Colorado peaches are in right now, and they are fabulous this year. Mm-hmm. Shocker. Really, really good. So as we start doing more preservation and talking about them, I think that shrubs are a good addition to the pantry. Apparently, you can keep them for months and months and months in the refrigerator. And they do, there seems to be two methodologies. One where you take the fruit and the sugar and you actually cook it. The other one, which it seems, I think, a bit more, will give you a more complex flavor, is where you leave it all raw and you let those wild yeasts come in. And then you will get a little bit of fermentation as it develops in the refrigerator. Probably they kept them in cold cellars or cool cellars, but this is really, really old technique. You can do several things with them after they have kind of produced their full flavor. You can either mix them with seltzer water or regular water. They're very thirst-quenching, like a lemonade, only, of course, we don't grow lemons in Iowa, nor in lots of parts of Northern Europe where these recipes were developed. Or you can add a bit of vodka or gin, and then you've got your cocktail. So they come in lots and lots of flavors. I read a couple of interesting ones. One is the elderberry one, which I'm going to make, and we'll report on that one. Another one was, this one kept coming up on the internet, a beet and lemon shrub. So this is, you take 5 cups of water divided, 2 tablespoons of white vinegar, 1/2 cup of sugar, 1 cup of fresh beet juice, and 1 cup of fresh lemon juice. And you just mix them all together and kind of let them marry in the refrigerator for a week or so. And people just were raving about it. So that's not really even fruit. So the idea is you have a vinegar-based drink.
A shrub. That sounds one good way to keep up with the bounty, because this time of year, heaven knows, things appear at your back door.
Right, they go so fast. And this one is really easy. There's no canning, no heating, the main thing is that, you know, once the fruit has sort of macerated in the sugar, you do strain it off so you don't get, like, the seeds in it or the little fuzzy bits or whatever. And so you've got a really kind of pure liquid that you put the vinegar in. And I really would recommend a homemade live vinegar. So we're going to be trying out some of those things. And once the recipes are perfected, we'll let you know.
Good. Sounds like a good way to keep up with the bounty. Because
yeah.
This is a good time for fruit. My kitchen looks sort of like a scene from The Sorcerer's Apprentice right now. I've been jellying and canning and doing things, so things are a bit sticky in there. But this week, wild plums are wonderful this year.
How about a wild plum shrub?
Sounds wonderful. So cooking that down, wild plum, end up with big bunches of juice. And if you don't want to make shrubs, I put it in clean plastic milk jugs into the freezer and deal with it later.
I do. But yes. You know, yes. You could always make the shrub later.
Later
once
is
you've
good.
Got that. And if it's frozen, your microbial content will stay, as well as the enzyme content, they will stay intact.
Oh, yeah, yes. Also, grapes. I have a few grapevines of my own.
What, like a Concordy?
Oh, they're the variety name is called Buffalo. It has nothing to do with Buffalo Sweat. It's called Buffalo. They're Concordy. They're just big purple with mm-hmm. seeds inside. Good for jelly. But check your French rows. As you're out there picking elderberries, there are wild grapes this year. Pick wild grapes. And I like to mix them together. The wild grapes have got an oomph to them that at least my grapes. So I let wineries grow much more interesting grapes. I have grapes that survive. So grapes, wild plums, elderberries, lots of stuff is going on now.
Oh, boy, I'm going to be shrubbing.
Very good. We were also going to talk about eggplant.
Oh, yes. I do like eggplant. We want you to all know that it's also sometimes called an aubergine, which is A-U-B-E-R-G-I-N-E. So if you're reading a recipe that calls for aubergine, that is eggplant. The British call it aubergine, as well as, of course, the French. So it's a kind of a common word that comes up. Now, there are lots of kinds of eggplants. I did a bit of research, so it seems to be like there are Indian, Thai, Japanese, Chinese.
Middle East and Mediterranean.
Yeah, and which is, of course, there's the U.S. eggplant, which is the big purple one that we're quite accustomed to. And then there are, Lana's got a seed catalog with the most gorgeous pictures. And then, of course, there are a lot of Italian eggplants. Some of them are more bitter. In fact, the Indian ones are so bitter that you have to open them up, take the seeds out, and then you shave them into a curry. But they're cute little things, and they're often colors yellow, red. They look almost like tomato-y things.
Right. Remember, the eggplant is part of the nightshade family.
That's right. And technically, they're fruits.
Yeah. So they can look like tomatoes. They can look like peppers,
actually. I'll tell you, if you see any that either are white or light purple striped, like the Rosa Bianca, which is my favorite, grab them. The white ones have a slightly thicker skin, but inside they are so delicious. Softer, creamier, just fabulous. And some of them are like the Japanese and the Chinese ones, which are kind of long and thin, and they can be green or purple. Or those are really easy. You just can grill them. Take the stemmy part off, cut them in half, put a little olive oil on them, and season them if you like basil, even oregano, salt and pepper, thyme. Put them either on the grill or in the oven. They go really fast. They're simple, simple, simple. Just, you know. Now, one thing I have to say, be sure you either cut the eggplant in half or pierce it, because I've had exploding eggplant in the oven. They are tight skin, and if you don't give them a way to release, they will do the job themselves. It was thrilling. I'll say it was thrilling.
Right. Some of the eggplant skins are tough, and mm-hmm. some you can eat. So check around.
And if you, for the tough ones, especially the larger ones, if you just cut them in half and then you roast them, you can scoop the flesh out, and you don't have to pre-peel them. It's easier to actually cook them and then scoop the flesh out, and then you get things like Baba Ganesh, which is very widely available. But making your own is really simple. You know, it's just basically mashed eggplant with a little lemon and salt and pepper, and, you know, season it if you want. Some people even put mayonnaise in there.
Put tahini.
Tahini, yeah. Gives it a very Middle Eastern flavor. In the Midwest. The other thing that I love about eggplant in terms of processing it is if you cut it up into chunks, like 1 inch or 3/4 inch, and you don't have to peel it, leave the skin on, toss it with some olive oil, and then I do throw in a little basil or, you know, one of those things, and just pile them on a big cookie sheet and roast them, then they're very easy to freeze that way.
Oh, I have never frozen eggplant.
Yeah, they good? Cooked, you can freeze them, and they're just great. Oh. They really last. Now, my favorite eggplant recipe, and it's not eggplant parmesan, which is good as well. That's kind of the classic. But is a Sicilian eggplant relish called caponata, C-A-P-O-N-A-T-A. The recipes are really easy to find. It's basically, now, for the traditional way, they cut the eggplant up into the 3/4 inch cube, and they fry it in olive oil. Oh, first you have to, like with cabbage, you have to salt it in the strainer.
Oh, now, that I've heard of that. That sounds interesting. Why do you salt it?
It draws some of the juices out, which are a little bit bitter, so it sweetens it up. I have to say, sometimes I skip that process. It depends on the eggplant, for one thing.
You salt the chunk, let them sit a while.
Yeah, and then, in a colander.
And rinse it.
You're supposed to, I believe, blot it dry or something. Oh. Yeah, exactly. So I often skip that. I'm quite the lazy chef here. And one thing that traditionally they do is then they fry all of those pieces in olive oil, which, of course, you'd want the water off of them because you don't want to put the water in the oil together. But I, having been trained many years to cut oil out and cut it out and cut it out, I do them. I spray the bits of eggplant with the olive oil spray, and I just put them in the oven and roast them. So that's how I cook the eggplant for that. And then to make the caponata, you've got your cooked eggplant, and you put in it's a pickled thing. So you put in pieces of pitted olives, capers, celery. I put onions in it. So it's an appetizer thing. Oh, and a little bit of tomato paste. And here's the secret ingredient. Chocolate.
No.
Powder. Cocoa powder.
No.
Yes. Yes. Almost everyone uses it. It's really, really good. And then after it's, you cook the celery, the onions, the tomatoes, and the chocolate. And sometimes I put coriander seed too. And then after that part is cooked, then you dump in the capers, the olives, and a fresh parsley and mint, and you mix them all together. So it's a little, it's acidulated from the acids from the, mostly from the capers.
Acidulated, word of the day.
Acidulated. So that makes it, it's really good. You can let it sit overnight. You can even freeze it. Sometimes I make huge batches of it, so I have it throughout the year. And then it's, you can serve it with crackers or, like a bruschetta on a toasted white piece of bread. And it's my favorite eggplant dish.
That sounds great. And I just bet you, giving a little bit of prodding, I could get you to post that on the website. What do you think? What do you think?
Okay.
To find past recipes and also to listen to past shows, go to khoifm.org, go to the section that says Talk, scroll down to Donalana Kitchen, and we've got a page there that has got past shows archived, recipes, and some other, there's a picture of us too. So go to that. And,
speaking of more recipes that we probably didn't post, the garlic scapes.
Oh, that's something else we need to post.
Okay,
we'll take a little bit of a music break here. This tune is called The Butterfly. Played by fiddler Kevin Burke. Thank you. We're back. This is Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI, Community Radio. Support your local community radio station. Appreciate everybody that supports us and gives us great ideas. If you want to give us some great ideas, contact us at KHOI Studios. Come down and visit us or email us at khoiradio@gmail.com and put Donna Lana Kitchen or DLK in the headline there.
Oh, DLK. Oh, my goodness. We have our own acronym.
That's it. That's it. Well, you want to type out Donna Lana Kitchen every time? No. Anyway, we are back. That was the fiddler Kevin Burke.
Which Bronwyn pointed out was in the Secret of Rowan Inish film, which we loved.
I love that movie.
Great. Oh, great song.
Good. Oh, good. Well, all summer now, Donna has been giving us Cool Treat of the Week. And here we are with Donna's Cool Treat of the Week.
Yes, we're going to be a bit Francophile again this week. This is called a Far Breton. That's F-A-R-B-R-E-T-O-N. This is traditionally from Brittany. You go into any little local store anywhere, and they've got them all sitting up there on the counter. I don't know how they do it. It's not refrigerated, whatever. But it is a really, really simple recipe. And so I translated from grams into cups, and it came out to be a cup of sugar, a cup of flour, 5 eggs, 3¾ cup of hot milk. So all you do is you mix the sugar and eggs really thoroughly, then you pour the flour in. Now you take the hot milk and you pour it into the egg mixture, but you know when you combine eggs and heat, you have to go a little bit at a time. You take a buttered baking dish, you pour it into the baking dish, and you put it in the oven at 350 for 10 minutes. After 10 minutes, and this is the characteristic part, you add cut-up prunes. Now, I used prunes that had been sitting in a brandy and Armagnac thing for 2 years, so they were quite tasty. But plain prunes are kind of the norm. So then you put the cut-up prunes in after it's cooked for 10 minutes, and you put it back in the oven, and cook it for 35 minutes till it's done. And then the hardest part is not eating it while it's hot. You can, because it's quite good. But if you let it sit in the refrigerator, it kind of, it settles into this more custardy-like egg thing. So continuing our eating on air tradition.
We have some right here in the studio, and yes. I suggest the forks ready, everyone.
Yes, and the thing is, I've tasted it. Most radio shows where you don't want to eat on air, we encourage lip smacking. What do you think, Rick? Take a taste. We got to get the report from the engineer.
I tell you, that's absolutely delicious.
It's sweet.
I haven't had anything that you guys brought in that I didn't like. I tell you that.
Funny
it's
about that.
Definitely a treat. I never had this before, but it's definitely very nice.
It's very good. It's a very peasanty dish. So, country folks, Midwestern, it's kind of like egg custard that we grew up. Imagine an egg custard with prunes put in it. How healthy is that? What do you think, Bronwyn?
Oh, it's wonderful.
And it's so easy. It's so easy. So that is our cold treat of the week.
It's called Far Breton. Far Breton is what it looks like.
Yeah, far.
That'll be on the website, too, eventually. So Donna's cold treats of the week have been really fun. And keeping up with our Francophiles sort of theme here, Donna traveled to France and came back with something called coconia beans. Tell me about your adventures.
Well, they're called the Plus. It's a city in Pampal, which is far into Brittany on the coast. So there's Poubazlinac, Plouezec, and these are different towns, all beginning with PLU. That's probably a Celtic naming system. And they had these white beans that one of our little neighbors kept giving me that only come in August. And they were the sweetest beans I had ever had. So I brought a package back, and they call them cocoa beans, just C-O-C-O. And there's actually, it's the cocoa beans of Pampal. You can't even buy them. You have to, it's like an AOC appellation. You cannot buy them in the market. Only the farmers that have the real cocoa beans can grow them and sell them. But so they do sell in packages another one called Cocagne, C-O-C-A-G-N-E. So I brought a package of that last fall and gave them to Lana, and she had planted them. And can you taste? We have another tasting for Lana. They're traditionally cooked with, oops, I just squirted the water, all the bean water all over. So it's a fresh bean, kind of like a butter bean.
Yes, there's beans come in many iterations. There are the green beans.
Which you eat immediately.
Brand new, you eat the whole thing. And then way at the other end of the spectrum, there are dry soup beans when the bean totally dries down and you take the little beans out. These are shell beans, which means...
You don't save them. You have to cook them.
Eat them right away.
You do have to shell them, and you eat them right away. And the traditional way they cook them is just with onions and carrots. What do you think, Lana?
One of the main wonderful things about this is that the beans are succulent of themselves. They're these little white, gorgeous little beans. They cook down, make their own kind of mushy green or mushy bean gravy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm eating them cold, but I'm sure they're served hot too. But they're very good. What's so nice about shell beans is that they are tender, tender, tender. But you're eating the little brown bean again. So
they taste a little like, not like a northern white bean. They're a little sweeter than that.
They're a lot fresher. These have not been canned. This was directly from the funny-looking, lumpy shell bean pods that start out green.
And in Brittany, it is a seasonal thing, kind of like butter beans are in the... Virginia or something. There's a season when they come in and everybody eats them like crazy, and then you can't have them after that.
It's like fresh sweet corn here.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Eat them now. The shells are long. The bean gets lumpy, and it actually has some little purple stripes on it. So it's green and purpley stripes.
And I suspect they pick them as fresh as possible. Like you had picked varying degrees of them, and some were drier than others. Mm-hmm. And I think they picked them because they were so soft and so sweet.
Mm-hmm. Well, Donna gave me this package, and I planted them out. Then I turned back to the package for reference, and the package is all in French. So I used my best high school French to try to remember this, and I sort of got the gist of it, but then I didn't get all of it. So this is probably not exactly like you had from...
it's close, though. And, of course, you have to figure out the difference in soil. They've been putting seaweed fertilizer on their soil for hundreds and hundreds of years. So it's going to be a little different than the Iowa soil.
That's why they celebrate them over there. And shell beans, you can have shell beans here. Grab those soup beans that are in the garden and eat them kind of... half ripe, half done.
Yeah, fresh.
Yes. Good, good. So that's Cocagne shell beans and how Donna discovered them. And they were great. They were wonderful. Our next upcoming show, our next week show is going to be with a special guest, Fred Kirchman. And you're going to be talking about...
Oh, Dan Barber's new book, The Third Plate. Yeah, we'll have a really kind of in-depth interview with Fred about the book and some good food literature.
You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Noctigal
and Donna Prisgintas
with excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Thank you to our special guests, Bronwyn Beattie Hansen of Wheatsville Grocery. We learned a lot about craft beer. You've heard music from a Celtic collection called Nua Terrain, a collection of Celtic music. And here's some fine dance music to go out with from Liz Carroll. Get your feet tapping. This is wonderful. Eat good food and enjoy life.